I was had been released on my own recognizance, but I was not allowed to leave the state. And this made it difficult because I had friends in Connecticut and New Jersey, and just all I wanted to do was get away for a weekend. But it was so humiliating to have to go to the court and ask permission to go 20 miles away that I couldn't do it. I went through a period of very, very acute anxiety. I would go to sleep. I couldn't fall asleep till about 4 in the morning. And then I'd wake up about 6 with my stomach just right underneath my throat and worry about what the next day would bring and what was going to happen on the legal hearings. And this went on for 8 months, and I was just totally exhausted, sleeping 2 to 4 hours a day. I couldn't even drag myself around anymore. All of the money I had gone to lawyers, and I went into debt to try to continue to pay for them. In the end, just the main lawyers cost $19,000. I was totally unable to write during this period. Obviously, you know, the depression was very, very bad, and I couldn't concentrate. I attempted to write, but it was really very bad writing. And I stopped eating because I was filled with such nausea and exhaustion. I would try to force myself to have a 16-ounce glass of Clamato juice each day and 2 eggs. About half of the time, I would just eat it and then go to the bathroom and throw it up. I just couldn't hold food in my stomach. A year earlier, I'd been operated on, and I was physically ill as well during this period. Mentally, I just totally fell apart about halfway through. I developed for the first time in my life acute agoraphobia. I couldn't leave the house. I think that this really started with this attempted murder that I felt had been intended for me. But then you have to remember that I didn't want to walk around my building because I was hearing people talking about the lady with VD. And I had been very concerned when they were going to arrest me, that they were going to arrest me in the lobby of my building and humiliate me among my neighbors further. So I think this was the genesis of a sudden inability to go out. And some of my friends were very, very good. They would come over and try to force me to get out and to just get my mind off what was going on. It worked for a while. Around September, October, it didn't work anymore. The one friend came over alarmed that I had not left the house for a week, and he said, "You just got to walk around the block." And I remember we stepped outside, just about 2 or 3 steps, and I just started crying, and I said, "Don't make me. I can't do it. I just can't do it." And then I went home and stayed inside for about 2 more weeks. And meanwhile, during this period of time, there was a new friend, who I met under somewhat mysterious circumstances, but he was very, very helpful. And I obtained an apartment for him in my building, and he did some of the food shopping that I could not get out and do. And his name was Jerry Levin. And at any rate, the worst period of time was approximately 2 weeks before the trial. My lawyers informed me that with a federal case, there was a 95% chance of conviction. They then gave me the good news that for the trial, they wanted my parents to be seated in the front row and watch the entire proceedings. And I kept saying, "We can't do that to them. It's going to be awful enough for them to read it in the papers." And they said, "You don't understand. If your parents don't show up, a jury doesn't realize that, you know, this is what you want. They're just going to..." They felt that the one circumstance that might get me acquitted was this unusually close relationship with my parents. On top of that, I was going through some Scientology material that I had obtained, and there was the name of Jerry Levin. Now, I felt horribly betrayed, but at the same time, I simply did not want to believe it. I was very naive, and I kept saying, "Well, it's a very common name, especially in a city like New York." Meanwhile, we had tried every single move possible to get the trial stopped, but I was in a very, very nervous state, and it became impossible for me to be tested correctly. And we went to some doctors who said that they thought the only thing that might work would be if I would go into a state where I didn't know what was going on, meaning sodium pentothal or truth serums, because to do that, you have to be, you're unconscious. It's like an operation. So the problem was we couldn't find a doctor who would give me a sodium pentothal test, because by this time I weighed 83 pounds. I had started at about 98, and it became very, very dangerous to go and put somebody under as if for an operation when you weighed that. And I kept saying I didn't care if the sodium pentothal killed me, because if I had to stand trial for what I didn't do and humiliate everyone and go through this humiliation, that I would just as soon be dead anyway. And we finally did find a doctor 2 weeks before trial who gave me a sodium pentothal test. I was unconscious for 7 hours. I don't know what I said during it. I do know that when I came to, my mother was standing there, and I said, "What happened? What did I say?" And she just said, "It's okay. It's all over. There won't be a trial." The government wanted to save face because they don't like to admit that they've made a mistake. So they said that they would postpone the trial, but they would not actually drop the charges at that time. They also ordered me to see a psychiatrist, which I felt was very humiliating. The government did not drop the charges, and for 2 years after all this, I still had to worry on a daily basis whether one day there was going to be a trial and all of these things that I was afraid of, the publicity and so on, was going to happen. The next year was 1974, and there were a number of new lawsuits against me. Continued harassment, including harassment of my family and their clergymen, new spies. By the summer, which would be about 7 months after the worst period of this whole thing, I remember one of my friends said that that was the first time they'd seen me smile in a year and a half. And I had decided, in fact, that I was going to try to get back this gentleman that I was interested in. And I threw a birthday party to have an excuse to invite him to something and sent him an invitation. And he then wrote me the most incredible letter back. And what I found out was that there was then a fifth anonymous smear letter about me. This one sent to him and his bosses. And he would never talk to me again and never has. In 1975, the charges against me were finally dropped. But during this period, they started a new type of harassment. And that is, I began receiving things in the mail, such as copies of, I had kept a diary from when I was 17 to about 20. And there was my diary suddenly coming back to me, copies of letters that I had sent out, my carbon copies of it. The psychiatrist report that Mr. Dardenneau explained that he stole. In 1976, in late 75, the charges were finally dropped. At that point, some very bizarre things happened that it wasn't until later I would learn were part of another attempt to put me in jail. But, for example, somebody was calling a number of my close friends, imitating my voice to a degree that was good enough that some people had stopped talking to me, others called and yelled at me, why should I have called and been so rude and so on. I kept saying, I didn't call. And then I went to a writer's meeting and someone said, gee, how was Washington? I said, I haven't been to Washington in 2 years. And they said, you called from Washington. I didn't understand at the time why these things were being done. Also, with a group of writers, and someone showed me a joke. And I realized afterwards that it appeared to be an attempt to get my fingerprint again. And I became very, very upset because, after all, I had a, quote, record, end quote. And I was very concerned about the possibility of more bomb threats. There are many, many more things that were done to me over the years. I'm trying to summarize a little bit. In December of 1976, I became very, very tired of it all. By that time, there were 9 lawsuits against me. Right before I went to court, all the stuff that was remailed to me that had been mailed in the past, sort of a subtle blackmail, kind of, this is what's going to happen if you don't settle. Scientology wanted me to settle quite badly. Also, they convinced me at that time that they had changed and that they really were a very nice organization, and that by my continued statements and stance against them and my book, I was preventing them from doing the good deeds that they wanted to do and that they were doing by bringing up the bad things all the time. And in December of 76, I agreed, in a sense, the easiest thing is to just say that I agreed, in a sense, not to badmouth them, and they agreed not to badmouth me. While they were telling me that they had changed, unbeknownst to me, there was a man named Michael Meisner, and he had been a top GO operative, and they were holding him under gag and handcuff. And this man knew that I had been criminally framed, and he knew about a lot of the things that had been going on. In the summer of 1977, the FBI raided the three Scientology organizations. On October 12, 1977, the FBI called me. Now remember that this was a five-year period that I had never been able to prove my innocence. The government considered me a criminal. I had a quote record, end quote. And the FBI called out of the blue and said, "We have just received evidence that you were innocent of those original charges." And I hung up the phone and cried. And I, in fact, tried to reach that person that was no longer talking to me, but he had since remarried. I worked with the FBI for the next couple of years. I did learn before, in the investigation that was going on, that the murder attempt on Joy was seemingly intended for me by Scientology. I learned that Scientology had broken into my New York lawyer's office. And this was one of many lawyers they were to break into, but that was the first one. And I learned, which was to me the most important thing, was that they had framed me in 1972. And I'm going to skip ahead a little to some of the stuff that there were more lawsuits. Anyway, the end of 1979, I finally saw the documents that had been seized. There were 23,000 documents. And there were documents... I'm sorry, 23,000 made available to the public. And there were two documents that finally made it very clear that I had been criminally framed. And it was very important to me that at last I was publicly able to proclaim my innocence and not worry about what anybody would say, and that I no longer, I felt that I had to hide the fact that I had been arrested. And if I would meet someone and say he had any political ambitions, I wouldn't tell him why, but I would quickly stop seeing him for his sake. So it was something that I was hiding, and it was affecting my life in various ways. We found one document that apparently indicated that they were considering the use of the mafia on me, but that they had decided instead to criminally frame me so that Scientology would not look bad. We found a number of documents that proved that this fellow who had been helping me, I thought, during the period that I was having such a bad time, he was calling in a diary into Scientology as to what I was doing, how close I was to suicide, and, you know, cheering me on like, you know, she can't sleep again, and she's talking suicide, wouldn't this be great for Scientology? Very painful reading the diary of somebody that you think is a friend and is wishing you dead and working in your behalf towards that direction. Incidentally, this particular fellow's name was Jerry Levin. They changed his name to Don Alverzo, and he became one of the biggest dirty tricks operatives down in Clearwater. He also was the person sent to Washington who planted the bug in the IRS. We saw a document called Operation Freakout, which Mr. Flynn started to show you before. I think, if you remember, I had mentioned these very bizarre phone calls, people posing as me. We think that they were trying to test my voice, because part of Operation Freakout, Operation Freakout consisted of six different ways to try to get me jailed again since the charges had been dropped. One of the ways was to call in bomb threats in a voice that would sound like mine. Another was to write bomb threats very similar to the original ones, but pasted on Writer's Digest stationery, so that they would come to the conclusion that the FBI would come to the conclusion that this must have been done by a writer. Operation Freakout consisted of plans to have somebody pose as me, to find out what I was wearing, have someone dress like me, look like me, and then crack up publicly and try to get me arrested for that person threatening to bomb various places. The other documents that I saw was that a number of these lawsuits against me were being maliciously created. For example, they were bringing my book, The Scandal of Scientology, into countries where it had not even been published. And they were saying, you know, so brought the book in so we can sue. The reason for those terrible calls that I'd mentioned was that they had put my name up on walls throughout Manhattan and with my phone number so that people would give me these calls. Operation Owl was in there. Incidentally, I don't know if I mentioned that Operation Freakout originated in Clearwater, even though the basis of the attack was against a New York resident, namely me. This has been showed you Operation Owl, which also originated in Clearwater. Oh, a copy of my diary, the one that had been mailed to me, was found in a file marked National Council of Churches, because they had hidden a lot of their stuff that they shouldn't have had. And there were also things that I didn't even know that they had done. For example, my mother once complained to me that she couldn't figure out why for the last few years my father kept being audited again and again, and nothing ever turned up. He's an excruciatingly honest person. And there was an order to give an anonymous tip to the IRS that my father was evading taxes. Now, I don't know if that was the cause of it, but I'm saying that it was this type of thing. I also learned from the documents that they were suing me for things that were true. For example, they repeatedly sued me for saying that Charles Manson was a Scientologist. And there were 50 to 100 documents showing how they were trying to hide the fact that Charles Manson had studied Scientology. There were surveillance reports. I think I'd mentioned that I'd been followed at various times and was pretty sure of it. It's kind of spooky sitting there and reading, you know, she turned up 80th Street, walked for 5 minutes there, stopped in the candy store. And there were reports that my friends were being harassed. There was a notation to cause trouble with this gentleman that I mentioned. There were spies reports and tape transcripts of telephone conversations that I had had with people. I think I spoke to 60 Minutes when I was down here in Clearwater last, and I said then that I had been saying that these types of things had been going on, and people kept saying, well, what is she talking about? This is a church. And it was an incredible vindication to look at these documents and see that everything I had said about Scientology since 1968 was true, and that they had turned out to be worse than anything I said or had even imagined. Now, Scientology at that time had said that they had changed, and I know because Gabe and Maggie Cazares mailed me the St. Pete Times and the Clearwater Sun, and I read that this is what they told you. While they were saying that, they had learned where I was in Washington, D.C., in fact, the Washington Hilton, and planted a bug by my bed there and also a bug on a telephone during this period of time while they were making these statements in Clearwater about how they had changed. And I do not believe that they have changed, and that is one of the reasons, or the main reason, I wanted to come here and warn you, because I have been studying them for many years, and I have heard them say that they have changed, and gee, they don't. They may even issue that kind of statement after this is over. Well, you know, there were some things that were said, but, you know, we don't do that anymore kind of thing. And I've heard it before, even before I started researching Scientology, they were saying this. For example, in 1965, there was something called the Australian Inquiry, a commission to look into Scientology. Anyway, after studying Scientology, the commission came to the conclusion that Scientology, quote, Scientology is evil, its techniques evil, its practice a serious threat medically, morally, and socially, its adherents often sadly deluded and mentally ill. And at that time, Scientology issued a statement that, of course, they had changed. In 1968, I believe, was the Foster Report when the English held an inquiry to look into Scientology. And Scientology issued a statement that fair game had been canceled and that the disconnect policy had been canceled and that everything had changed. In 1975, they had World Prayer Day, and the press almost believed that time that they had changed. In December of 1976, when I settled with them, I believed they had changed. In 1977, when the FBI raided them, they said that they had changed. In 79, when statements came out about what was in the documents, and in 1980, again, they were telling people that they had changed. And my final point is that I believe that they haven't changed. I believe that their basic policy, ever since the policy was first written, has been the fair game policy. The policy is to trick people. The policy is to sue people. The policy is to lie to people and to destroy them. I certainly know from a personal standpoint. And so I've only briefly told you some of the things that they've done to me, so that you're not deceived by their true nature. I've been studying them 14 years and unfortunately have been a victim of this cult for 14 years. And I believe that Scientology has never changed, will never change, and will keep issuing statements to people saying that they have changed.
Thank you for your...
If I could just make one point of information for the Commission of Legal Significance, the most relevant portion of Ms. Cooper's testimony is the fact that for years she suffered from harassment and framing, which has been proved by some of the documents already in evidence to which she's testified in the documents that we put in evidence before this commission. The fundamental area for this commission to examine is that of deception. On all of the items that I mentioned earlier, deception on confidential auditing information, Mr. Hubbard's background, the goals, policies, purposes, and practices of the organization for the thousands of people that are coming here to Clearwater and paying millions of dollars. Ms. Cooper's evidence vividly describes the policy of the church to utilize the fair game policy, of which most church members who are paying millions of dollars do not know. And that policy has been described from 1968 in her testimony right up to the present time. And the commission will be able to derive whatever inferences are appropriate from her testimony with regard to the practice of deception regarding the goals and purposes and operations of the Church of Scientology in this city.
Well, to say thank you for your story and thank you for the evidence that relates specifically to Clearwater. I have at various times talked to members of the Church of Scientology have told me that they have changed too. As recently as Hubert Gents of a few months ago, who said that they have changed. And I thank you for telling us the story. I don't know that every story today seems to get more incredible as the people come on. And I don't know how you could survive what you have survived mentally. You must be one hell of a woman. Okay. I really have no question. I don't know how you could even... You can trust anybody anymore. A man that you might meet, that he is not one of them. And trying to get you again. That must prey on your mind. And even with just day-to-day contacts with business associates and females and family members. So I don't want to put you through any more of your story. You've lived it in an aberration for these many years. And I will then refer to my colleagues, and I hope that they will also be sensitive to that fact and also be brief. Who do I start with?
I have just one question, and it's not so related to what happened to you there, but you said you spent, 13 years in studying Scientology?
Well, I started researching in 1968, so it's 14 years, I guess.
In this study,
yeah,
without any reference to religion,
mm-hmm,
and going back, have you found out where they picked up these deceptive ideas from, or who's... were they L. Ron Hubbard's, or did he get them from somebody else, or what?
Oh, when I researched the book, I went through a tremendous number of early policy letters by Hubbard, things that he wrote about in the early 1950s, even when it was Dianetics. And fraud just started way back. Hubbard himself, it seemed, was just constantly lying to his people. You'd find that, you know, one thing just totally negated another. And I think the deception or lies demonstrate from Mr. Hubbard.
Okay. Does anyone have any questions? Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Cooper.